The wildlife that live in Wisconsin, I think, you know, the variety of wildlife we have is what kind of one of the wonderful things about living here, isn't it? Not only do our natural areas provide some great opportunities for the wildlife, but certainly for us for recreation. They're a very important part of the state's economy. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. And great to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven with us. He's going to talk about the issues that are likely to be considered at the DNR Spring Conservation Congress hearings that are coming up in just a couple of weeks. And we'll talk about how you can participate. He's also going to let us know if this long, cold winter is slowing down and how it affected our wildlife. Scott, great to have you back.
Good to be back, Larry.
The Conservation Congress hearings are coming up on Monday, April 14th at 7 o'clock in every county of the state. And maybe let's talk about that for a minute. First, tell us what the Conservation Congress actually does.
Well, it's a chance for citizen input, really, and it's been around for a long time, organized by counties. There are delegates elected, and that will be part of the upcoming meetings on Monday the 14th to elect the county delegates. They form the Congress, per se. Then the Congress mm-hmm. holds these hearings for the public. And the Congress itself is organized into a variety of committees, a big game committee, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then those folks work on conservation, wildlife conservation, fisheries conservation issues in the state, and make recommendations that go before the public at the spring hearings and are considered advisory to the Natural Resources Board. So the hearings that are coming up on the 14th once a year are open to the public. I mean, anybody, they have a reputation, and we've, over the years, we've gone back and forth on the program about this. The perception is that it's strictly a hook-and-bullet crowd, and in some counties and in some circumstances, yes, it's dominated by hunting and fishing interests, but anybody is free to attend. And you recall the thousands of people who turned out back when we were considering dove hunting, mm-hmm. and then there was that fiasco with cat issues a couple of years ago. Nothing particularly contentious at that scale on this year's docket. But the point is, this is a chance for anybody to go and speak their mind, yeah. regardless of how they feel about hunting and fishing or whether they're participants or whether they aren't. So every county, 7 o'clock, the 14th. Now, in terms of the things that are going to be considered, there's a couple of new wrinkles this year. For one thing, new for this year, the annual spring deer herd status meetings will be held in conjunction with these hearings. So these provide an opportunity for hunters and other individuals to discuss the status of the deer herd and ask other deer management questions. So that's a new wrinkle in the so people who are interested in that also want to attend the hearings. And then the proposals that come up are in some cases generated by the Congress itself, in some cases come from the DNR, and in some cases come from the Natural Resources Board. So there are wildlife and fisheries advisory questions. The one that is kind of a carryover from last year that will probably generate the most interest is the trolling situation statewide. Up until this is resolved, the state is kind of a patchwork quilt of, yes, you can troll in the Madison Lakes, for example, but you can't historically troll in traditional musky waters in
Class
the North
A musky
Woods.
Lakes, yeah.
And that's where the controversies come in. I think there's some sense, and you as a musky fisherman can certainly speak to this, that wide open trolling with the normal limit of 3 lines per person could be is viewed by some as a concern for the musky fishery. So the proposal for 3-line trolling last year met with mixed reviews, so they've come back with a new and improved version of last year's proposal that talks about a statewide allowance of a single line of trolling, while you might also be casting another rod or whatever, but only one line essentially being trolled. Anyway, I expect this one will get a lot of attention. On the wildlife side, the Conservation Congress is going to be putting forth a proposal to give the DNR authority to develop a hunting season for tundra swans. That might generate a little bit of interest. And one that I'm particularly interested in, and I've been talking to some other folks on here, there are some bass questions for the fisheries. But the State Natural Resources Board has an advisory question on establishing a single hunting stamp that would be purchased by all hunters. Hmm. So it would take the place of the pheasant stamp, turkey stamp, duck stamp, and so forth, probably be called some sort of a habitat or conservation stamp. It would likely be a little less expensive than the sum total of the other stamps, and it would be earmarked for essentially some of the same types of management purposes plus general habitat conservation. So deer hunters, too, would be included in this. So that's a huge pool of people.
Yeah.
So even the less expensive stamp may still generate more money for conservation. So it's hard to argue against more money for conservation. But on the other hand, our stamp programs have a rich and lengthy history.
Yeah.
Some people are pretty interested in the art competitions and the collection of the stamps. And
there are all these stamps in
They're rather pretty. So there's mixed feeling on this, too, and I don't know how that one's going to go. But these are the kinds of things that will be discussed. So, I mean, there's even something for stamp collectors at the Conservation Congress hearing. There's something for everybody. So if you're interested in the outdoors, hunting, fishing, deer management, conservation, stamps, whatever, Monday night the 14th, the place to be is the Conservation Congress annual spring hearing.
Marilyn and Montfort, we get to you in just a minute, but I want to mention that, Scott, you recently joined the board of the Natural Resources Foundation. You're leading one of their field trips this year. It's already full, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, the one I'm doing on August 2nd on small mammals is full. We opened a few more spots the other day. I don't know what the status of those is right now, but registration for the 150 field trips that the foundation is sponsoring and has organized, which is a Herculean task, by the way, for the coordinator. Mm-hmm. Registration opened yesterday on the 1st. A lot of them were filled up by member registration, so that's a good reason to join the foundation. Not only is that a good thing to do anyway, and the money goes directly to conservation of our state's most prized pieces of real estate, but that gives you first cut at the field trip registrations. And, you know, these get more and more popular every year, and it's an opportunity for folks of all ages to get out for anything from a fairly brief, not too labor-intensive effort to learn about who knows what, to some pretty rigorous trips and some day-long trips. So there are train trips in natural areas, there are stream ecology trips, there are fishing-related trips, there are so-called birding blitzes, which will get us into talking about the Birdathon in a few minutes, which is coming up in May. Things about birds, about reptiles and amphibians, a couple of bat trips, the small mammals, a bunch of visits to different natural areas, just about anything you could think of.
Oh, it's really nice.
And access to places that you otherwise would have no clue are there or would not be able to find or just wouldn't get onto, and all led by people who are pretty knowledgeable.
Really know what they're doing.
In the site or the species or the taxonomic group that they're talking about. So there's all kinds of hands-on stuff. The trips are identified as being kid-friendly. The amount of physical exertion necessary is indicated. The costs are pretty low. Some are designated as fundraisers for specific causes, and there are therefore a little more money, but there are pontoon boat trips at Horicon, there's a Mississippi boat trip or two, just all kinds of cool stuff. And there are several ways to for people to take a look at this. Even if they're full this year, the thing to do is join the foundation and get ready to be Johnny on the spot next spring. And you can go to wisconsinconservation.org and see the whole litany, or if you don't have one, you get a copy of this month's, the April edition of Wisconsin Natural Resources magazine, and the whole deal is featured in the magazine.
I noted that the magazine came just the other day, and I was going through it and looking at the various, kind of drooling over a few of those events.
Well, there are some really nice places. I signed up for four of them, I think, or three or four, in addition to the one I'm teaching, and I'm trying to see the specs here. They added, this year there were 30 more trips than last year, with a capacity for 500 more people. So the program grows every year. It raises a lot of money for conservation, which is the bottom line. And I'm already planning, as we discussed a few minutes, planning a couple of new trips next year on, well, we won't lend to the surprise, but it grows and grows and grows every year, and thousands of people get to participate, and the demand obviously suggests that, boy, these are really fun. So
there
you have it.
They really are a lot of fun. Scott Craven, our guest today, wildlife ecologist, Marilyn and Montford, thank you so much for waiting.
Yes, I live in southwest Wisconsin, and we've been enjoying seeing snowy owls in the neighborhood and wondering how long they're going to be around or if they've left. I saw one a week ago.
Well, Marilyn, I think the problem right now is that Wisconsin is, as a state, is dramatically split between spring staging a big comeback here in the southern part of the state and Arctic conditions continuing to hold on in the north. And from what I saw the weather map this morning, it looks like we're sunk as far as tonight and tomorrow is concerned. Rain here in the south, ice in the middle part of the state, and maybe a lot more snow in the north. So really depends on where you are. So I think it's possible that those birds, along with a lot of migrants that are starting to come back, are going to be stuck here in southern and some parts of central Wisconsin, especially with this new storm. So it may be very good for viewing birds. I can't speak specifically to the snowy owls. I haven't heard of any reports in the last week or so. I would have expected them to be pulling out of the south by now, but they may be short-stopped by the weather they ran into as they head north. So This is an excellent opportunity to turn to our highly skilled and enthusiastic audience to see if anybody's still seeing snowies, and if so, where. So give us a call. Mm-hmm. On the subject of other birds, you know, coming into the area, at least around my place, tons of cranes back, the red wings, the robins, the killdeer. We saw meadowlarks yesterday, had a big flock of white pelicans over the house on Sunday afternoon. That was pretty cool. In that high wind, they were just kind of hanging there for 10 or 15 minutes. So a lot of stuff's back in the extreme south, but they're going to run into trouble as they head north.
My wife said that she was out running and heard of the first sandhill crane call of the year, and it was really made her smile. It always makes you smile when you hear that first time.
I'll tell you what, it sounded better this year than any other year after the way the winter's been. So
you have got that right. Scott Craven, our guest, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Email us at talk@wpr.org. or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Lynn in Coloma, let's turn to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm on Pleasant Lake in Washera County, and we're right on that little corner down southwest in Washera County. And we're all really, well, our lake is still frozen, I can tell you that, and there's no spring birds. But we're really concerned about these high-capacity wells and the pumping that they're doing. And it just seems like the legislature just wants to continue to just pump, pump, pump. And we've already lost a couple of lakes in our area. Other than the lawsuits we've got going, what else do you do to preserve your lake from being pumped out?
Mm-hmm. I'm sympathetic to your concern, and over the last few programs, we've had questions like this and about frac sand operations and the mining issues up in central northern Wisconsin. And frankly, you know, these broader environmental issues are a concern and eventually circle back to aquatic systems and wildlife, but I'm just not the knowledgeable person you need to speak on what the current regulations are or the picture of high cap wells in Wisconsin. I don't know if you know anything about that, Larry, if you have anybody on who can talk about it. But
well, as a matter of fact, that's a topic that we should be addressing, and I'm not sure that we've certainly discussed it in the past on the show, but I'm making a little note here. And for our Wednesday program, that's when we deal with environmental things. Lynn, we'll get somebody on to talk about high-capacity wells. Thanks a lot for calling and reminding me about that, because we haven't really done anything. Appreciate your call and appreciate having Scott Craven with us, wildlife ecologist. He's an emeritus professor from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Kathy and Racine, you can join in with your question. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for calling or taking my call. Yes, I believe it or not, I live in Racine, and I have a gully that's towards one of the end of the Root River projects here, and there's actually two sets of owls that travel along the gully here, and I'm wondering, you know, what are some things I could do to, you know, maybe put food out or do anything for the owls, because, you know, when it's at dark 30 there, and you see them at the top of the tree and hear them hooting, it's just, it's the coolest thing in the whole wide world, and they're so big.
So these are probably great horned owls?
I'm thinking they are. Okay. I never really seen them, but I hear them all the time.
And by two sets, you mean two pairs?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, great horned owls are, they're pretty impressive birds if you get a chance to see them up close, and the hooting carries for long. Everybody likes to hear that. They start hooting really early in the spring. I mean, it's actually winter. They probably have young by now, and they're neat birds to have around. And the reality is that just about every woodlot, small patch of woods, edge of woods, gully in Racine, or any other wooded habitat in a park or a green space probably has a pair of horned owls. They're pretty common, and they're pretty conspicuous because of the hooting. In terms of doing something for them, there's not really very much you can do. Protecting, if they had a favored perch tree, for example, that they hunted out of, or if you knew where their nest tree was, then protecting that from some type of cutting or clearing or disturbance or whatever else would just be a common sense thing to do. But in terms of providing any element of food resources, they are pretty effective hunters, and they will take a variety of prey, and if you maintain the as close to natural an environment around you as you can or in that common property in the gully, such that there are rodents and rabbits and skunks and other things that owls will take, that's about all you can do. But putting out, trying to put out a, you know, a hunk of T-bone or something, not necessary. And with beef prices now, probably ill-advised. So
I was thinking maybe I could put, you know, hang a mice from the tree or something. I don't know. But it's just the coolest thing in the whole wide world, just to hear them and hooting. And I know that they're hunting.
Yep. And they're very good at it. And they're there because there is a food resource and a habitat resource. If you just do what you can to make sure that stays, you'll have your owls to enjoy.
And good luck. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. Take care. Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. Appreciate your call. And Jill in Rhinelander, thank you for calling. Hi.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say red-winged blackbirds are back here, and I just saw my first chipmunk.
All right. That's pretty good news. Did it have little snowshoes on, or was it...
Well, it was running across the top of the crust of the frozen snow pretty good.
So what's your snow depth up there now?
Oh, well, I could be gross, but no, it's pretty deep. An area that doesn't get plowed that's in the center of our driveway, it's got to be at least 2 feet.
Yeah. And you're expecting more here over the next couple days?
Yep.
Oh, great.
Like, say another 6 inches maybe, so.
Okay, well, the red wing will probably be back here by my place within a day or two, and I'm glad to see the chipmunks out. I'm sure the animals are just as anxious as we are to see spring arrive, so that's good news. There's hope for Rhinelander after all.
Yeah. Well, the red wing's been eating the suet.
They'll do that, and they're very dependent on, this is a key time keep your feeders filled up, because some of the migrants that respond to seed will really need it when they get back and find 2 feet of snow.
They go after the seed too, but it's really been hitting the suet. I imagine it's pretty hungry.
Yep, absolutely. So. Thanks, Jill.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Joanne in Lac des Flambeaux. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about black bear. Mm-hmm. With all the snow we still have on the ground, would they still be hibernating, or does their internal clock say it's time to get out, no matter how much snow is on the ground?
Well, I would guess the bears will be out more or less the normal time, snow or no snow. The snow cover may make them a little more irritable, and it's going to be tougher to find food resources. So people who live around bears should, you know, exercise all the necessary caution they usually do. But I think the deep snow and cold probably didn't have a great deal of effect on the bears. In fact, two or three feet of snow is pretty darn good insulation. So as they were sacked out for the winter, I don't think that probably bothered them a whole lot. So I've not heard of any reports. I mean, this is a good thing, again, to turn to the listeners all over the state, see if anyone's seen bears out yet. But I've not heard of any, so we'll see what happens.
Okay. I was just kind of concerned about our bird feeders. And my husband, when the weather was so terribly cold, brought the trail camera in, so he's got to get that back out so we can monitor if we see the big boy or not.
Get the trail cameras back out, and that'll lead us into a little discussion in a few minutes about a neat camera project coming up that you might be interested in.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for calling. You know what? Why don't we talk about that neat camera project?
Okay. Let's do it. So, as I think many people in the conservation community are aware, Wisconsin's been the beneficiary, as many states have, of a bit of an uptick, considerable uptick in funding from the federal government through the Pittman-Robertson excise tax program. And that money has been just a godsend in terms of allowing some large-scale creative projects that, like the deer research we've been talking about for a couple of years, that maybe no one ever really thought we'd have the money to do. So this latest project is a pretty neat one. It's really not going to kick off, other than as a pilot program in two counties this fall, full-scale implementation next year. But it's called Snapshot Wisconsin. And it's essentially a trail camera-based plan to blanket the state with a reasonably regular distribution of trail cameras, operated and monitored by citizen scientists, people like the last caller who may have some familiarity with cameras anyway, and are interested in what's around their area, to go through some training, be provided with a camera by the DNR, and they're talking about end project maybe 3,000 to 4,000 cameras deployed, and the folks will monitor these cameras, upload the photographs, and this will be part of even a national or an international effort where these go to a large website or server where other people have an opportunity to view the pictures, figure out what they are. But the data collected from the camera monitoring all over the state will assist and refine the monitoring of a bunch of different animals. Just as an example, here's the snapshot contributions to wildlife management fact sheet. It talks about beaver, black bear, bobcats, deer, elk, gray wolves, otter, and rare species observations. So, for example, elk. So the statement here is the number of elk in the Clam Lake area is a source of discussion each year, and a new reintroduction of elk is pending for the Black River State Forest. Snapshot Wisconsin is a promising, cost-effective approach for monitoring the reproduction, distribution, and size of the current and reintroduced herds. In the case of, let's say beaver.
All right, take beaver.
Beaver are monitored with indices to population size in an aerial survey in the northern third of the state. Snapshot Wisconsin, together with other remote sensing data, can be used to locate and validate beaver activity locations, thus providing the first year-round and statewide beaver monitoring program. And the same is true for all of these species, and I think it would likely be expanded to more. The cameras are non-selective. They'll take pictures of whatever goes by. So there's no telling what other information may be collected. But this is a pretty cool way to capitalize on the current interest in trail cameras.
Love it.
And to mobilize a group of like-minded, willing people and provide them with the cameras and get them out there. I think it's going to be pretty neat. Just the few pictures we get each time we're on. We're talking about the potential for thousands and thousands of photographs here.
That's very cool.
Of all sorts of species. So, as I said, this is planned for statewide implementation in 2015. So people interested should sort of stand by. You know, we talked a bit before the show of getting the coordinator of the program on in a few months to talk about this with us, and I think this is going to be pretty cool.
Oh, I do too. I really do. And, it'd be fun to have her come on and you know, as we get closer to it, and maybe on with you, and we'll just spend a few minutes during the show to talk about it more.
All right. Excellent.
Fully. We have lots of callers online, and an email from John in Shatek who said, my wife saw a bear along I-94 just south of Eau Claire on Sunday. So the bear are out in the Eau Claire area, at least one.
At least that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Willie was worried about the loons. Last year, many were lost due to icing. Are they in danger this year because of the late business? You know, the lakes being frozen so late.
Maybe, and yeah. there were problems throughout the winter in that areas that historically didn't freeze did. And there were problems not just for loons, but for a lot of waterfowl that were finding themselves on a frozen lake and essentially no place to go and yeah. had problems. But the real crunch time is going to be over the next few weeks. Even with the deer in the Northwoods that we've been worried about for months, you wouldn't really expect normally the mortality to occur in the herd until about now.
Yeah.
And in through April as the snow's actually disappearing. Because that's kind of their push to the extreme, and that's it. So there's still time to tell, I guess, as far as the impacts on a variety of species, including loons.
We have Maddie in Wisconsin Rapids up next. Maddie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I bought a house recently, and the people who owned it before me decided to plant pine trees everywhere. And they drive me crazy. So I'm taking them all down this spring. And I'm leaning towards putting in fruit trees, but I don't know what kind of fruit trees will benefit me in my home winemaking and the animals in my area or certain birds like trees. Or I'm just curious to know which ones are better to plant for the wildlife.
Well, how big a yard or property are you talking about, Maddie?
I have a full acre.
Okay.
Not much, but...
Well, and are these pine trees, are they white pines, red pines? Are they mature, great big, tall, thin trees?
They're in the middle. They're white pines. I have one, another type of pine. The only one tree in my yard that isn't a pine is an apple tree.
Okay.
The berries that come on it don't form full apples, but the birds really like it, so that one gets to stay.
Okay.
But the rest of them are coming down.
Well... All right, so there are a couple of things to think about. First of all, I wouldn't necessarily wipe out all the pines.
I'd leave one anyway.
Mature trees are, it takes a while to develop a mature tree, and a few conifers or evergreens, like white pines, are always a good idea for thermal cover in the winter and shelter for a number of different species, particularly birds. They don't provide much by food resource, but they're a very good shelter tree. And, In my case, I started out with essentially an open landscape, planted a couple of thousand pines and spruce along what was built as a wildlife travel corridor along the boundary of my property. And those pines are now 30 or 40 feet tall, and it is amazing how effective they've been at creating a travel corridor for everything from turkeys and deer down to rabbits and small birds as they move around through the farm country of southern Wisconsin. So bottom line, pick a couple pines that have a nice shape or that look nice from your house and leave them. And then your strategy to move toward trees that produce fruits of some type is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Almost anything will enjoy apple trees. You get some apples out of it, and most people who have apple trees are fighting a battle to keep wildlife out of their trees rather than the reverse. But a few apple trees that you leave available, I mean, they're certainly attractive to deer. Any twigs or whatever that fall on the ground or trimmings or prunings that you leave, the rabbits will love. And as the apples freeze and thaw, if you leave some on the tree, there are a number of birds that will use them. It's a good idea. And then there are all sorts of hawthorns and crab apples that produce edible fruits that you won't use, but they can be really thicker than a normal apple tree and produce fruits and cover for a lot of birds.
Cherry trees? No?
You know, black cherry is a good tree for birds, a native tree.
Yeah, I like black cherry.
Black cherry's a nice tree. There's an extension publication you might want to get a hold of at your county extension office called Landscape Plants That Attract Birds.
Yeah,
and it talks about all of the different shrub options, high bush cranberry and dogwoods and whatnot, service berries, all the various plants. In fact, service berry or amelanchier is a really nice one. It produces a lot of fruits that the birds like. Anyway, pick up that publication, and those plants are discussed by ultimate growth form and size, and I think you can pick plenty of stuff to fill up an acre with no trouble at all.
Oh, yeah. And you can go online just to the... The Learning Store at the UW, learningstore.uwex.edu, or just type in UWEX Learning Store, and you can view that publication online. Landscape plants that attract birds and animals.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Reed in Cedarburg, hello to you.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I commute between Milwaukee and Oshkosh each day, and the other day while I was driving north on 41, I saw up close a mature bald eagle in Washington County. And that struck me as being really unusual, and there was absolutely no mistaking it. It was a bald eagle, and it was feeding or had killed something alongside Highway 41. And so I got to thinking, how common is it to see bald eagles this far south? I live in Cedarburg, and I know we have a nesting pair in Ozaukee County, but I was really surprised to see a mature bald eagle in Washington County. So I'm just wondering how prevalent it is for them to live in southeastern Wisconsin.
They are pretty much all over Wisconsin at this point. So there are nesting pairs here in Dane County and counties around the area. There's a pair near the farm I've hunted on for years out in Iowa County and a big white pine tree. So eagles are doing pretty well, are pretty widely distributed. I can't speak to the specific distribution in Washington County, but the fact that you saw one doesn't come as a surprise to all, any at all. A, they're pretty big and they're pretty visible, and a mature one with the white head and tail, it's our national symbol. If there's one bird that everybody in the country should be able to identify, it should be an adult bald eagle. So when people do see them, they get identified and not, you know, misrepresented as something else. And they're very much attracted to roadkill. So, you know, a deer carcass on the side of the road is a pretty popular spot as far as eagles and some other scavenging birds are concerned. So they're out there where people see them. My suggestion as far as the specifics of Washington County, get a hold of the local Audubon Society chapter or nature center in the area, or just call the local DNR office, and I think they'll be able to give you a pretty good description of what the nesting distribution is, if in fact there are any nesting pairs in the county.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks a lot, Reed, for calling. Appreciate it. Jim at Colfax. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. Two days in a row, Larry. I feel special. Let's see, the lady that called about the pine trees. Pine trees are excellent. Scott, you're 100% correct. My father has planted them for 50-plus years along with his father. I should say 80-plus years plus his father. They're excellent habitat for the deer, all wildlife. The grouse love to get underneath the boughs and snuggle up in there. Great cover during the heavy snowfall. Just the critters use it for cover. Bear sighting. I seen a bear west of Bloomer on my way home on Highway 64 right next to County Road M where you'd turn to go to Sand Creek. So that's up in Dunn County. And about a 200-pounder, and he's about 100 yards off the road. Had no concern of anything. I stood outside the vehicle just to kind of get his attention. He wanted to do nothing but just kind of sit there and looked like he was waking up. It looked like he was kind of drowsy yet. But
but that was Monday.
The program. Yeah. That was on Monday night. Yep. Yeah. So they're just starting to wake up. So I can tell. I keep my eyes open daily for him because it's, I've been kind of wondering, too. Last year at the same time was a mother and her cubs had come out of a culvert right when it started to warm up when the water was getting high, so they needed to escape that culvert.
You know, you should go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, Jim, and everybody else for that matter. We've got a number of great photos up, including one from Kirill of a mama bear outside of her den over a week ago. Pretty sure she has two cubs. If you look closely, you can see the back of one. Pretty exciting to see. So that's pretty cool. And then we had William sent a photo of a red fox, isn't it? A fox hunting.
Yep.
Pretty cool. He got with a long lens. And Kelly's got a shot of a snowy owl and some geese a couple days ago, and that was at Goose Lake, or Goose Pond, excuse me, Goose Pond.
Cool. All right, so the information's coming in. Bears are apparently out, and there's still at least one snowy owl around.
All right, and let's thanks again, Jim.
And I should say on the white pine front, you know, beyond the fact that they're a good habitat tree, I mean, my interest in planting a bunch of them, I don't think there's a more pleasant sound outdoors than wind in the white pines.
Yeah,
that plus the fact that they're nice and soft and they're green all winter. White pines have got a lot going for them.
I think you're right. Jackie in Milwaukee, thanks to you for calling. Hi.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My cold is better. She
Good.
Even asked about it. I've got food out there for everything, from ducks to the wild, and a lot of song warblers I don't recognize coming in. But I am one of the few who had the first robins that I saw today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the ice coming in, can I put out bread and chopped apple and stuff for them? Is there anything else I can do for them? Because they can't get through the ground.
Well, yes, there are some things you can do. If this is I know there's some nasty weather coming in, but hopefully this time of year we get nasty weather, but then a couple of days later it moderates and
yeah.
It clears up pretty well. And the robins can certainly take a few days of that. Bread won't help them very much. Chopped apples might. Raisins are good. And if you go to the bird feeding store, they'll have some seed mixes that contain some chopped fruit for this period of early spring kind of feeding. So there are a couple of things you can put out. The problem is getting the robins to explore a feeder.
Yeah.
I've had lots of robins in the backyard for the last week or 10 days. But they don't come anywhere near the feeding stations, whether it's my...
Oh, I'm going to put it on the ground.
Well, you can try that or get a little platform raised up or something. The problem with on the ground, of course, is that at night the rabbits and so forth are going to get it, so...
With coyotes in the neighborhood, I don't have a rabbit anywhere.
Oh. Wow, you're a very lucky person.
People would like that, but I... rabbits, I've got coyotes, foxes, I live on a creek. You name the wild thing, it's been here.
Well, anyway, give it a try with either seed mixes mixed with fruit, chopped apple, raisins, things like that. That's what they will respond to if you can get them to find it. So,
yeah.
Good luck.
I haven't heard about raisins. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Jackie. I'm glad your cold's over. Appreciate
it. Oh, I sound more like me now.
Yes. Yes, you do. Jackie calls every so often with a question. It's always fun to hear her voice. And Sue and Sister Bay, let's hear your voice. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I did see a bluebird on my deck the other day.
Oh, you're lucky.
Which, well, Sister Bay, I don't know something about up there, but I was thrilled. I have a question about wild turkeys. I'm a real estate agent, and one of my properties that I have listed is empty, and it seems that the wild turkeys have found that out, and they're gathering on the front porch for parties, and they leave a real mess. Is there anything that the owner can do to get rid of these turkeys, discourage them?
Well, despite the fact that turkeys are popular for a lot of reasons, they do occasionally cause some difficulties over the years. You may remember the story about the turkeys harassing mailmen in the Madison area,
yeah.
And panhandling at houses. And, of course, they've been very common around people with feeding stations this winter because, like any other bird, well, they're mm-hmm. big, but, gee, they need food, too. So they've been hanging around feeders. They'll sometimes get up against windows and peck and whatnot, but... The fact that, so this is the owner of the house that's vacant that they're trying to sell, or the new owners?
Yes, they're trying to sell the house, but it's difficult to show it because of the mess that the turkeys leave.
Well, I mean, some potential buyers may feel that's an amenity, but I don't know about that. You'll have to see. But I think that as things get warmer here and the turkeys disperse... The males, the gobblers are going to be off displaying and attempting to attract hens. The hens are going to be interested in breeding and nesting, and they're not going to be hanging out in groups like that much longer. So I think the problem will correct itself, But in
that
the meantime, if this isn't a huge deck, you know, a big sheet of bird netting that would be used to protect a fruit tree, for example, you can buy it in huge sheets and just simply stretch that from the railing up to the house or whatever and staple it on a wood surface, you'd completely exclude them from being on the deck.
And you could easily pull it back when you were going to show.
Right.
Thank you. I appreciate
that. And there may be anything that you put on the deck that would blow around, like pinwheels, or go to a garden center and ask for something called a scare eye balloon. It looks like a big beach ball with bright, shiny eyes on it and some mylar strips hanging down. And if you hung that in the middle of the deck from a shepherd's crook, I'm not so sure the turkeys would go anywhere near it.
So there
are lots of things you can try, but that should be a manageable problem.
Thanks for calling, Sue. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. Great to have him along. I'm going to go to Bob in Eau Claire next, who has a question for you. By the way, that number for you to call is 1-800-642-1234. And now we turn to Bob. Thank you for calling, Bob.
Good morning, guys. We had four deer on in the yard yesterday. Just as an aside, we had been throwing corn out for blue jays and crows, and there was quite a bit of it laying around. And a doe came in with three fawns and played Hoover, and they really tucked into it. So that's the first time we've seen them in the yard since we've been here. I want to add one more thing about having an evergreen screen around the yard. We too have an acre here, and we're south of Eau Claire, about 3 or 4 miles in an older development, and we inherited these trees. And these trees have been magnificent. You cannot believe the rich variety of birds and wildlife that those trees provide cover for. Plus, they screen the house from the severe winds in the wintertime. And anytime we have winds out of the north or northwest, you hardly feel it when you walk outside because those trees are providing a buffer, and I'm sure that has really contributed to our heating bills over the years. Mm. So I wouldn't touch a single one of these trees here, and we've got spruce along the road, so there's a variety of white spruce, and there are a couple of blue spruce. So it's an interesting mix. And then we've got that's anchored by a huge red pine, and then more spruce on the north side, and then along the east or back side of our yard, we've got mostly white pines. And again, it has been great. And we still have got apple trees in the yard. We're planning to put a couple of crab apples in this year to provide them for especially for the migrating birds in the spring and fall.
Well, you've had a lot of good comments here and a lot of good trees from the sound of it, Scott.
I think the pro-pine momentum is building, Larry. I don't think we can stop it now. So.
No, I don't think so either. Bob, that's a great call. Thank you so much. And just to go along with it, stay listening here for a minute. Michelle sent a note on Facebook about her pine trees. She says she has three in her yard for cover. Every year, several pair of mourning doves rest and nest and hatch young in the shelter of those white pines. And she said it's just a lovely thing to watch and experience that. So there you go.
There you go.
So the gal who called in earlier about getting rid of all her white pines, please don't do it. Save some. Russ in Janesville. Hi, thanks for calling.
Morning, Larry.
Morning.
A week ago today, there was a wolf killed on the interstate right by the Pine Island hunting ground there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering how far the wolves are coming south now. And he was a big guy. The state patrol was trying to pick him up, and he had all he could do to get him in there.
Well, I mean, largely because of the evidence gleaned from road kills and trail cameras and so forth. I mean, as we've talked about before, although the stronghold for wolves is still the northern third of the state and parts of west central Wisconsin, there's not a county in the state that doesn't have the potential to see a wolf, especially one not necessarily setting up shop or a pack setting up shop, but just passing through. They can cover tremendous distances, and any county in southern Wisconsin is between the stronghold population in the north and places where dispersing wolves have been found in other states that had affiliation with Wisconsin. So when it comes to wolves now, just about anything's possible in terms of sightings.
Yeah. Thank you, Russ. Peter in Waukesha, hi. Are you there, Peter?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I had a question about voles, actually.
Okay.
Serious infestation of, well, what we consider to be voles, although any reference online doesn't seem to compare to what these are, small little 3 to 4 inch kind of hairless, black-looking little creatures that have just taken over the lawn entirely. And we've spoken with the pest control or lawn care people, and they said the only suggestions they had were putting down a specific application once early here in towards the end of April, and then once in the fall again. That is a like a scent of a fox or something like that that will actually just chase them off the property. Other than that, it's really hard to eradicate them.
So by taking over the lawn, you mean as the snow finally disappeared, there were all sorts of trails and runways around the lawn? Looks like they've been having a picnic out there all winter. Is that
Absolutely.
What you're seeing? Okay, so
yeah.
So that is the work of voles, although there could be several different types of small mammals in your yard, including little black or dark charcoal gray shrews, which look like they have much shorter, sleeker hair. And they're there to eat the voles,
okay,
among other things. But
yeah,
the what you perceive as damage to the lawn, all these little trails, was done by the meadow vole, or a whole pack of meadow voles, and they can be incredibly abundant. I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds to the acre of grassy habitat. So they frequent the grass under the protection of a blanket of snow. Once the snow is gone, so are the voles. And although it looks awful, before we have a couple warm rains and the grass begins to sprout, the reality is that the damage to the lawn is cosmetic only, and after a couple weeks of good lawn growth, you won't know the trails were there. So, and furthermore, the voles have now dispersed. What's around you? Other yards, or do you have any green space or a ditch or anything like that nearby?
Well, it's a corner property, and there is an adjacent field across the street that suspect that's where they're coming from. But they don't appear to be in any of the other neighbors' lawns.
Okay, well, the other harbor... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, by putting out live traps, what appears to be getting captured then actually is the shrews,
mm-hmm,
which you say are there to actually combat the voles.
Right, you don't want to get rid of the shrews.
What were you baiting the live traps with?
Just the hard, like rat bait. What's it called?
Decon or something?
You know, the pellets. Yeah, they did like decon.
Okay, so they weren't live traps necessarily.
They go in live, but they don't come out, right?
Okay, well, in any event...
I meant in the sense that we're not, using snap traps, right?
Okay,
like
well, I understand. But the bottom line is that voles can be so abundant that snap trapping is almost an exercise in frustration. You just can't keep up with the numbers. So that the time to deal with voles is not now when the damage is a post facto thing. The time to deal with voles is in the fall before snow flies. Do you have a lot of landscaping around the house that's mulched or anything like that?
Well, that was some of the concern, was that there is the mulch that is around the perimeter of the house, and they seem to travel around the perimeter of the house the majority of the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then extend out into the lawn, like you say, over the winter.
Right. So yeah. the place to do, if you want to do some trapping, do it in the mulch or right up around the perimeter, the essentially the sill plate of the house. That's where they may still be harbored, essentially. But there'll be no activity out in the lawn now that it's exposed. And if you can avoid catching the shrews, that's a good thing to do. But sometimes they're just collateral damage. So you could be trapping at any time. I think that the baits, there are some baits that are specific to voles that can be applied underneath a piece of board or shingle or something like that. And snap trapping with a simple mouse trap baited with peanut butter is very effective too. But I don't think this April yeah. application of fox yeah. urine into your yard is going to help a whole lot. So I would.
It's going to help the person who puts it down.
I would try a few things first, but that's not something I've heard of as being particularly productive.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus Professor of Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin and with UW Extension. He comes by the first Wednesday of every month to talk with us about the wonderful world of wildlife. And you stay with us. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After a long, cold winter, I'm sure you're anxious to get outside and enjoy all that Wisconsin Natural Resources has to offer. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Just getting outdoors can be fun and a pleasure after a winter like we've just had. That is for sure. And it's even better when you have somebody like Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, to be your guide. Scott comes by once a month to talk with us about what's going on in the outdoors. And Scott, always great. Thank you so much for coming by.
Oh, no problem. Always good this time of year. Lots to talk about.
One thing we can talk about is a birdathon that is coming up, and I know we want to make sure that we mention that because...
Well, it's a big deal. It's another, much like the field trip program that's so popular, it's another fundraiser sponsored by the Wisconsin, by the Natural Resources Foundation, coming up in May. And it's really an effort for, or it's really an opportunity for people interested in birds to join the funding string for lots of bird conservation activities. So the funds raised through the upcoming Birdathon will support the Bird Protection Fund, which is a partnership effort, and that supports everything from the Bird City Wisconsin program that's been getting a lot of publicity to supporting important bird areas, the Stopover Initiative, reforestation in Costa Rica wintering areas, the Second Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, all kinds of things that are really important to bird conservation. And there are lots of ways that people can get involved. And I think we'll talk more about this as it gets closer, maybe on yeah. other shows. But people, birders, or people interested in birds can either support a signature team. In other words, this is a case of birders going out and obtaining pledges mm-hmm. from folks or businesses on based on how many species they find. And there are signature teams, well-known birders from around the state leading teams in various places. For example, Bill Volkert's leading in the Horicon Marsh team, and one of my faculty colleagues, Anna Pigeon, is leading the Northern Highlands team, which is their forestry summer camp group up at Kemp Station, much like Jamie and David and I did last mm-hmm. year with the forestry summer camp. So you can hook up with those teams on the wibirdathon.org website, make your pledges that way. You can go on one of the Birding Blitz field trips with an expert. Those are part of the Foundation Field Trip Program, and your donation and registration fee there includes a $75 tax-deductible donation that goes to the Bird Protection Fund. You can do it solo. There are school programs and prizes for schools with binoculars and things for the school teams. it's a neat program, and it's up for the month of May. You can find out a great deal more by going to wibirdathon.org, and we'll talk more about it another time.
And Hank in Brantwood has a question for you, Scott, so I want to get to him. He's been waiting quite a while. Hank, hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call for afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, yesterday I was out wandering in the woods, and about 40 yards off, I spotted what appeared to be a cougar. I have taken some classes from Dr. Halfpenny at Tree Haven regarding tracking. Tracked this animal for a little while and was able to get some photographs of his prints. The prints are about 5 inches long by about 3 inches, a little more wide. And you can definitely see the four pads, the four toes of the cougar. It looked to be about 4 to 5 feet long with a long, black, bushy tail. The cat was black in color also. My question is, when I took these classes a couple years back, Dr. Halfpenny indicated that there are no breeding cougars in Wisconsin. Does that still hold true, or are they breeding out here?
Well, the breeding part of it is the kicker. Yeah. Over the last few years, there have been 4 or 5 or more animals documented, photography, DNA, and tracking, and so forth. So clearly there have been cougars moving through the state. They're the famous one that went through Wisconsin, was ultimately shot by police in Illinois, and others that have moved through. And I have no reason to doubt that there aren't somewhere in Wisconsin right now. But the coloration that you describe bothers me a little bit, and that the tracks are generally the palm size track fits, but the cat tracks in general are more round than oblong, and the dimensions you gave are more rectangular. And you said it was dark. It had a dark tail.
It was dark colored. And talking with folks up here over the last several months, this animal has been sighted by other folks up here also, or at least one similar to it, over the last year or so. A black, it's not a weasel, not a raccoon, not a coyote or a wolf. The body shape doesn't indicate anything like that.
So you're sure it's not a fisher?
It was awful big to be a fisher.
Okay.
It was standing. It was above the ground, and the snow up here, there's a pretty firm crust up here. Yeah. You break through the crust about an inch or two below the crust, and you get into some powder. The impression of the track broke through the crust in a number of places, and I couldn't get to follow it very far because of private land that it crossed. But the impression in the snow was probably about an inch or so deep, so it had some weight to it to be able to break through the crust.
Yeah.
Well, I can't speak to that, and without seeing the tracks or sending them on to some of the DNR folks who are pretty good with this, we'll just have to speculate. But in answer to your question about breeding, no evidence that I'm aware of that any of the cougars that have been or may be in Wisconsin have been breeding, so no evidence for that, but certainly supporting evidence that we have had cougars and probably still do. At least a few of them in scattered locations. But what you saw with the dark color, I'm not so sure. So, if people have been...
I would take that to the DNR, local DNR office.
Yeah, take the information local DNR office, urge the people around there who claim to have been seeing it as well to get their trail cameras out. And if somebody gets a picture of it or you get better pictures of the tracks or something, send them on or take them to the DNR office, and somebody will help you figure out what it is.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much, Hank, for calling. Appreciate it. We have other callers online. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Bill in Boscobel. Hello.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, for the last couple of years, I've been feeding the deer. And they're always in my backyard every winter, and this last winter it was really bad, which. But I've had quite a few deer there eaten, and a lady happened to hit a deer right outside my yard, and the DNR happened to stop in and we had a little conversation about what to feed the deer. And they told me that I couldn't feed corn and stuff in a concentrated area. Now, my question is do you have any kinds of food that I could plant, like in food plots or anything like that, that would be legal for me to feed the deer throughout the winter?
Well, the problem here, Bill, is that in southwestern Wisconsin, which is all in this chronic wasting disease management area, feeding deer is flat out forbidden. No questions asked. It's not a matter of in areas of the state that are not in counties adjoining CWD positive counties, which I've got to think Boscobel is. There are restrictions on, you know, how many gallons in a particular feeding or bait site, but more and more counties, I think pretty close to half Wisconsin counties now, are under a feeding ban. And this is one of very few tools that are actually being used to attempt to do something to slow the spread of chronic wasting disease, because the deer concentrated on a food pile with body fluids and slobber and so forth transferring is a problem. So direct feeding in the winter is simply something that shouldn't be done. And I guess I don't know what the nature of the conversation was, but and we don't need to go into that, but the problem is that that's not something winter feeding, despite the gut-wrenching issues with the kind of winter we've had and deer that really look like they're in a bad way. We just have to bite the bullet and not do it. In terms of putting out or creating habitat that's food rich for the rest of the year, or that might even carry over natural food for the winter, that's a different story. And there are some people who are a little anxious about the distinction between a food plot and dumping out food. You know, why is one right and the other one wrong? We could argue that until the cows come home, but let's not. The point is, there are lots of things you could plant. Or if you've got ag land and convince your farmer to leave a few rows of something, there are lots of things that deer utilize. And if you just get yourself a copy of Quality Whitetails is the name of the magazine. It's the publication of the Quality Deer Management Association. And there'll be all sorts of ads in there for food plot mixes and things you can plant that are attractive to not only deer but other wildlife.
Yeah.
But it's hard to beat a few extra rows of corn left in the odd corner of a field. Turkeys and deer and a lot of other squirrels and raccoons and a lot of other things will use that. And that, which tends to not concentrate the deer in such a tiny place as a bucket of corn, is still viewed as a distinction, and it's okay to do that. And a food plot, in general, is just another good practice as far as wildlife conservation. But what you put in is going to determine what equipment you have, whether you have a sharecropper who has equipment, what you want to plant or deal with, and a magazine like that. There is also some books you can find on the internet that deal with food plots. And, in southwestern Wisconsin, the local chapter of QDMA, the Quality Deer Management Group, I think it was a week or two ago, just had their food plot seminar for 100 landowners here in southwestern Wisconsin, and all sorts of seed mixes were available for sale. So lots of ways you can figure out what the best thing for you would be to put in. But that's okay. Feeding in areas affected by chronic wasting disease, no matter how much we want to do it, we should avoid.
Yep, there you go. Good luck. Thanks, Bill. Brian in Wausau, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding bats. Do they leave for the winter? I've got an old rental cabin in Tomahawk, and I've got a couple hundred bats that have seemed to take home between the old asphalt roofing and the metal roofing that was put over the top.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to figure out if they leave, if I can try to plug up the holes where they are, if they are gone now, or what would be my best approach?
In most cases, Brian, especially in one like that where they're really pretty exposed beneath that metal surface, the odds are grossly in favor of them leaving for the winter.
Okay.
Depends a little bit on the species, but in most cases, they'll leave. And the party line used to be that in 95 cases out of 100, bats would leave a home or dwelling for the winter, and the winter was a period when, or very early spring before they got back and got active, or late fall after a couple hard freezes, were the times most people would do their bat proofing or exclusion. Whether that means plugging holes or a new roof or whatever, it depends on the building. But those were the times to do it. Now, the game's changed a little bit over the last several years with the impending arrival of white nose syndrome, which threatens some of our bat species. Several of the species most commonly involved in home colonies have received legal protection, and there are some restrictions on what you can and can't do. For example, there's a window from, I think it's June 1st to August 15th, where you can't do any bat proofing at all. And there are also some provisions that before doing some of this work, you need to run this by the DNR has a bat team now working on bat management. Not only can they give you some other advice beyond this, but they can tell you what, if any, legal provisions there are that you need to be cognizant of before you do any work. But this is typically, especially up near Wausau, you must still have snow on the ground. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, if you can get up there and do the work, this is a good time to do it. But I would just run this just to be on the safe side with the new regulations. Run it past your local DNR office. Tell them this is what you're going to do. And they're either going to say, go for it and good luck, or give you some additional pointers, or tell you if there's any legal requirements you need to satisfy before you do the work. But the odds are pretty good in your situation that the bats are not there. If you start doing any work and encounter bats, then you'll have to go to plan B. But I think you'd, in a setting like that, you're likely to be okay. So this cabin was unheated all winter?
Yes.
Yeah, that's very unlikely that the bats stayed there during the winter. But you don't have a whole lot of a long window here to do the work before they may be back.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Brian. And Dave in Janesville. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good afternoon, guys. I've got a local squirrel nest. This is in the city, and three of last year's squirrels have parts or most of their tails missing. One's got a one-inch stub, one about 2 inches, and the other maybe 4 inches. I'm wondering why in one local population like that their tails are missing.
Good question, Dave. I saw one run across the road yesterday as I was driving around town with almost no tail, and it is pretty funny looking, or I shouldn't say funny, not humorous from the squirrel's perspective, but odd looking sight to see a tailless squirrel. Now, what happened? I don't know. Whether or not there's you know, in some cases, something that's been grabbing them, a potential predator, there may be damage. Do you see, I guess the first question is, if you've got a good look at these animals or you see them all the time, is the tail itself, in other words, the bone structure that supports the tail, is that there and the tail is just naked, or is the tail just gone?
The tail is just gone.
Okay.
Looks like they were cut off or something. Cooper's hawk, is that a possibility?
There are probably a lot of possibilities, but we'll never know for sure.
Okay.
The one thing, you know, when you say it looks like they're cut off, I'm not sure I even want to bring this up, but it's not uncommon for people who are less tolerant of squirrels than others. They're easy to catch in a live trap, and if someone's trying to get squirrels out of their yard or away from their home where they may be causing problem in an attic or whatnot, I could see the possibility that in terms of, boy, I wonder if these darn squirrels are coming back. I've got one in the trap. Pull its tail through the trap, snip, snip, let it go, and then you're seeing the result. I don't know what happened to those squirrels, but anything from that, which I hope wasn't the case, to a close encounter with a predator, to some problem in their nest or whatever that's, you know, they've got something, who knows, something sharp in there that they're coming in contact with. I'm not sure, but those are some of the problems. I don't think that there's probably a, you know, genetically a population of bobtailed squirrels there that you're probably dealing with, but that's probably one of the more unlikely explanations.
Thanks, Dave.
This autumn was a little unusual for
everyone. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is, especially kind of right in one little spot. Yeah.
Yep.
Pat in Duluth, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We've had pileated or pileated woodpeckers nesting in our yard in past years. But this year there's some behavior that I just wanted to run by you. For over a week now, we've had the female pileated who comes to two trees and one telephone pole in our backyard. And at first I was really worried because she was puffed up. I mean, she's out there like from mid-morning until some nights, some days until like, you know, right before it gets dark, like 5:30. And she just is resting on these trees or the pole. One day, the male and female were on the telephone pole, and I heard a third pileated in the back wooded area. So I didn't know if it was territorial, and I've been watching her the last 2 days. She'll be on the tree, and then she flies to the suet and eats the suet, and then will either go into the backwoods or she'll come back and be on those trees for long, long, long periods of time. And so I don't know if this is normal. I've never seen this before.
All right.
Are there nest holes in the trees that you're describing?
Well, several years ago, I saw a nest hole and babies in it when I was putting out compost. And this year, I've been watching a hole that's fairly big in the poplar tree, but I've never seen anybody going in and out of it.
Okay.
Well, I would expect if there were a nest hole there, and for those years you recall that I worked up in northern Wisconsin for a couple of years, there were two well-used nest holes in red pines just outside the office window. Watching the pileateds was pretty cool. They're a beautiful bird.
Yeah.
And seeing the young poke their heads out of the holes and all was a pretty neat thing to do. I would have expected the female's activity like that if she was really seemed to be attentive to a couple of trees, that there'd be a nest chamber there or a potential one. And if the bird's hanging out and not utilizing them, there may be something else in the nest cavity, like a flying squirrel or something.
That's
a little bit of a dispute over who's got possession of the hole at the time. But if that's not the case, why she's hanging out there and not doing much else and just seems to be, as Pat described, resting, I can't. I have no explanation for that. I think, Pat, you're just going to have to be observant and see how things play out here. I would expect, unless the bird is somehow sick or injured or debilitated in some way, you're going to sooner or later see some nesting activity, and this may resolve itself, but I don't know what else to tell you about it. And if any of our, not much time left today, but if any of our skilled birders have an alternative explanation, give us a call.
Report to us in May. Report to us in May, Pat, as to what you're seeing there. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Actually, we are out of time. Alexandra called to say that she saw her first butterfly. So there's a lot of firsts. Her first butterfly this morning near Lake Geneva.
Outstanding.
So we've got butterflies, we've got bears, we've got all kinds of birds. Loons, people are sighting loons now. Spring is springing. Not so much in the north, but
it's about time.
Scott, we will look forward to your next visit. By the way, that birdathon, what a great name for a birder and a pigeon. I like that name for a
bird.
That's well. There you go. Thanks, Scott. He'll be back the first Wednesday of May. Tomorrow we'll learn about the Wisconsin Farms Oral History Project. And then Bassam Shakashiri and Jerry Bell talk about the world of science. And, gee, thank you so much for listening. And I hope you will stay tuned because, as always, there's lots of great information in store here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.